Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, September the 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Obama gives a sobering view of world politics in his final UN address. The presidential candidates weigh in on the weekend terror attacks.
These attacks were made possible because of our extremely open immigration system.
Humanitarian aid under attack before arriving to help refugees in Syria. Also ahead, Brangelina is no more.
What drove them to split after six children together?
It's all on today's International Edition. Well, VOA's International Edition begins with President Barack Obama hosting the first ever Leaders Summit on Refugees in New York City on Tuesday, saying the world is facing a crisis of epic proportions.
We are here because right now, in crowded camps and cities around the world, there are families from Darfur and Chad, Palestinians in Lebanon, Afghans in Pakistan, Colombians in Ecuador, who've endured years, in some cases decades, as refugees, surviving on rations and aid, and who dream of someday somehow having a home of their own.
The president said the worst global refugee crisis since World War II is first and foremost a test of the international community's ability to stop conflicts.
To slam the door in the face of these families would betray our deepest values. It would deny our own heritage as nations, including the United States of America, that have been built by immigrants and refugees. And it would be to ignore a teaching at the heart of so many faiths, that we do unto others as we would have them do unto us.
The president issued a call to action to other world leaders and private companies to join together to make a difference in the lives of refugees. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more on the summit from the United Nations event.
An unprecedented 65 million people are displaced across the world. Syrian Mohammed Badran is one of them. He has resettled in the Netherlands and said he has seen firsthand Europe's struggle to cope with the influx of people.
There is intense public fear about refugees. As young refugees, we face this anger and fear every day. Doors are closed to us. Higher education is denied to us. We are often dismissed, not taken seriously, and underestimated.
Member states agreed to increase support to countries most affected by the crisis and boost humanitarian funding and the resettlement of refugees. But a plan to ask governments to resettle 10% of the world's refugees each year was dropped.
Refugees and migrants are not to be seen as a burden. They offer great potential if only we unlock it.
The International Organization for Migration, which has 10,000 staffers working across five continents, officially joined the UN family Monday.
So for the very first time in 71 years, the United Nations now has a UN migration agency.
The UN has also launched a campaign against discrimination and xenophobia relating to refugees and migrants as countries close their borders to the growing human exodus. The human rights chief blasted leaders who oppose greater responsibility sharing and promote divisions over refugees and migrants.
Some of them may well be in this hall this morning. If you are here, we say to you, we will continue to name you publicly. You may soon walk away from this hall, but not from the broader judgment of we the people, all the world's people, not from us.
His remarks resonated throughout the hall. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
But in light of the bombings in New York and New Jersey here in the U.S. this week, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump had this to say.
There were Islamic terrorist attacks in Minnesota, New York City, and in New Jersey. These attacks were made possible because of our extremely open immigration system, which fails to properly vet and screen the individuals or families coming into our country.
The main suspect in the weekend bombing is a naturalized U.S. citizen who came here as a child. Meanwhile, Democrat Hillary Clinton, also in New York for the General Assembly, offered this response.
I appreciate greatly your words of support after the terrorist attacks that we have experienced here. This is a threat that faces all of our countries, and we must redouble our efforts to meet this challenge together.
Prosecutors have now charged 28-year-old Amal Rouhami with 5 counts of attempted murder. His alleged motive for the bombing still unknown. He is the only suspect so far, but the FBI says it is looking for any links to foreign terror groups. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. One pilot dead, another injured in a California spy plane crash. Tribal leaders say IS is regrouping in the Afghan-Pakistan border areas. The U.S. presidential debate topics announced. And a new film shows how the Beatles helped fight segregation. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States is accusing Syria of conducting airstrikes on aid trucks, which on Monday had been attempting to reach besieged Aleppo. The UN and Syria's Red Crescent said the multi-agency convoy aid from Turkey for thousands, tens of thousands of people was hit. Jens Larki, communications officer with the UN Office of Humanitarian Affairs.
This very, very dark day for humanitarians in Syria and I say across the world, because I think there has been a moment of shock and, frankly, disgust by this attack. At this point, we remain committed and undeterred to continue, to the best of our ability, to help all Syrians in need.
The trucks were targeted by military aircraft, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. It came as a tenuous one-week ceasefire appeared to dissolve, with Syria's military blaming its collapse on U.S.-backed opposition forces, U.S. Deputy National Security Officer Ben Rhodes.
We hold the Russian government responsible for airstrikes in this space, given that their commitment under the cessation of hostilities was to ground air operations.
It remains unclear whose aircraft struck the convoy, but a Pentagon statement late Monday quickly disavowed U.S.-led coalition involvement.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. President Obama mentioned the importance of dealing with climate change when he spoke at the UN General Assembly. But lost in the headlines in the U.S. on Monday was that a group of 375 scientists from around the world, many from the National Academies of Science, wrote an open letter in the Washington Post with a serious warning with what's at risk with regard to climate change. The letter starts by saying, quote, "The climate is changing in dangerous ways, and we are responsible for most of these changes. This is not a matter of conjecture or political opinion. It is the conclusion of overwhelming majority of climate scientists." based on solid evidence that mounts each year. Now, scientists, it says, know climate change is a threat. Politicians need to realize it, too. Joining me to talk about this, Scott Mandia, professor of Earth and Science, Space Sciences at Suffolk County Community College in New York. Scott, why did these scientists do this?
It's clear that humans have caused the planet to warm. We're warming at a rate that is not sustainable. We're entering into a dangerous territory if we don't start reducing burning of coal, oil, and gas. And politically now, we have two candidates. One accepts the science and wants to do something about it, and the other candidate believes it's a hoax or that it's not a problem. And Trump also wants to pull out of the Paris Agreement, and the Paris Agreement was really a watershed moment for the world. We had 190 countries essentially say, look, we can't let the world get warmer than 2 degrees C, warmer than it was before we started burning coal, oil, and gas, or all kinds of bad things are going to happen. He wants to back out of that, and in fact, he actually wants to ramp up the burning of coal, oil, and gas. And I just saw a message yesterday. Some insiders think that if he is president, his Secretary of the Interior is going to be a former executive of an oil company. So clearly, if that happens, we're not going to see any reduction in our burning of fossil fuels. And that signals the rest of the world that you don't have to do it either. It's the United States has to lead on this. If they pull away, then it gives everybody else an out also. And then we all sort of go down in the burning house together.
What finally prompted scientists to gather together collectively to put this message out there?
I can tell you, as a scientist and also knowing many of the individuals who have signed this letter, in the past we've had presidential candidates who have been a little shaky on climate change, basically saying, look, I'm not going to sign this Paris Agreement and we need to, you know, drill, baby, drill. So he's really taken it to an extreme. And I think scientists at this point realize we're really running out of time. I mean, it really comes down to mathematics. There's only a certain amount of carbon dioxide and methane and these other heat-trapping gases that we can add to the atmosphere before we go beyond what are known as tipping points, where things start happening so quickly we actually cannot adapt to them. And I think they just looked at this as he has a chance to win, and if he does, we could see 4 or 8 years of not only inaction but going in the reverse direction. And we just don't have time for that.
When you say we really are unable to do anything and we're going in the wrong direction, can you give me an example?
Yeah, for example, in science we call them tipping points. So here's an example that Dr. Richard Alley, a famous geology ice guy at Penn State, you think of New Orleans and you think of levees, for example, and you have sea level rise, and it's slowly rising over time. And as long as that water stays below the top edge of the seawall, all those small changes are essentially unnoticeable because you're on the other side and you're dry. That last inch of sea level rise now is over the top and the entire city is flooded, and you're like, oh my God, what just happened? So you went from something that was slow and you just didn't notice, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's changing your world. And it's kind of like if someone's just very, very slowly pushing you toward the top edge of the staircase, no big deal until that last little push, and then things unravel very quickly. So we've noticed in climate there are several things that appear to be happening slowly, but then they reach that point. And another example would be the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. The West Antarctic Ice Sheet is actually sitting on the seafloor. The water is so warm now, the bottom of the ice has melted so much that the bottom of the ice is now above any of those bumps. And so there have been several papers in the last few years that show that the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, it's already, we've passed the tipping point, that it's going to go into the ocean and completely melt, and that's going to cause 20 feet of sea level rise. But it's a done deal. We can't do anything about it. So that's a tipping point that was already passed. There's a chart they call the burning embers diagram that shows different sectors of society, you know, freshwater resources, infrastructure, you know, food, species, you know, tourism, and it shows what temperature warming we can go to be able to adapt, and if you go beyond that, you pass a tipping point. And for most of those things, 2 degrees Celsius above basically 1850 temperatures is the tipping point for many of those sort of burning embers. And that's why you've probably heard a lot of scientists and policymakers saying we can't warm the planet more than 2 degrees C. And the Paris Agreement, they actually said, let's see if we can do 1.5 degrees C, because we just see those tipping points. It's essentially running out of fresh water, crops just not being able to make it anymore, those types of things. So crops are withstanding the heat right now, but it's not much longer before basically they just start failing everywhere. There are scientists who worry about taking a position like this because, as a scientist, the greatest asset is your ability to be objective, to essentially look at the data and let the data drive your conclusions. So there's no preconceived notions. Look, what is the data telling us that's happening? So when scientists sign a letter like that, there is the fear of many of those scientists, I'm sure, particularly ones who maybe chose not to sign it, that is this going to look like I've no longer become objective? And I think that's why it has taken, in my opinion, too long for many scientists to really step up to the plate and sort of enter the political fray. I look at it as I'm a scientist, but I'm also a voting citizen. So I have a right to use my knowledge to educate the public when it comes to policy. And I think more and more scientists realize that standing on the sideline to preserve the apparent objectivity, that maybe their voices aren't being heard.
When you talk about fear,
yeah,
what is your biggest fear?
My biggest fear is because I have two boys and I see the geopolitical implications of a world that the population is growing, resources are shrinking, and global economies are so tied up now that a few disasters or, you know, some wars because people are basically climate refugees could quickly unravel basically our civilization. And I didn't want to see my boys going to war for something stupid like, hey, we warmed the planet, even though scientists were telling us for years we shouldn't be doing this.
All right, we appreciate it. Scott Mandia, professor of Earth and Science, Space Sciences at Suffolk Community College in Long Island, New York. With all the international problems plaguing the world, it's always a good idea to look at history and one dark day at the events that led to the end of World War II, Pearl Harbor. Newly uncovered information about what led to that day is being released in a brand new book called Pearl Harbor. And joining me now to talk more about it is the author, historian Craig Nelson. Craig, thanks for being with us. It really has come to be known as that day that will live in infamy.
Well, that's a great story, in fact. There was a tremendous squabble at that moment between the Japanese Army and Japanese Navy, who had been squabbling for the past 3 decades, where the Navy did not want to attack the United States without warning. So they decided that the Navy would, Foreign Office would present their final terms 30 minutes before the attack, and that that would be fair. Mm-hmm. However, the Army then changed the language of the message so that no one understood that this meant the start of war, and they delayed it so it came out an hour and a half after the attack. So that's how infamy began.
And your book really goes behind the scenes and talks to people, the remaining survivors, which is fascinating in and of itself.
What we found out was that the last really definitive history of Pearl Harbor was researched 50 years ago. And that was a book called At Dawn We Slept. And there's been so much that has come out since then, especially from the Japanese side, from Pearl Harbor survivors who couldn't talk because they were basically traumatized. They really couldn't discuss it for decades. And even stories of civilians who were there and Japanese Americans in Hawaii and the aftermath of Pearl Harbor meant in American history, that it's really almost like an entirely new book, an entirely new perspective. For example, there's a famous Torah, 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 which is the launch of the attack, which everyone has heard meant tiger, 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 and it was a secret code. But that's just a coincidence. It actually is two words, To and Ra, and it means for the torpedo planes to attack, and everyone in the Japanese Navy involved in the mission knew that meant that it was a complete surprise and that America had been caught totally unaware.
Given the political climate we are in right now, it's sort of an interesting contrast. I see here that you also talk about America's diplomatic blunders that contributed to Pearl Harbor's in the months leading up to the attacks.
Some of what we found seems very familiar to us with recent events because, for example, one thing that happened is that repeatedly the Army and the Navy told Roosevelt and his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, that Hawaii was impregnable, that Japan was physically incompetent race of people who couldn't possibly attack Oahu. There were 35,000 troops stationed there. They wouldn't think about it. They were much weaker than the United States. And they kept this up for months and months and months until, and what this led to was that Hull and Roosevelt were belligerent in negotiating with the Japanese. And we found that there were many moments where they could have negotiated a peace accord by figuring out a way for the Japanese to save face and exit from China, which was the big stumbling block. And we could have actually not had ever had a Pearl Harbor or a Pacific Theater. But because we'd been told by the Army and the Navy that things were so great, they took a very hard line. And then on November 5th, 1941, a little over a month before the attack, the Navy and the Army said, oh, wait a minute, actually, Japan is very powerful in the Pacific, and you need to play for time. And by then it was too late.
Some of the stories of the remaining survivors and veterans, what was it like to talk to those folks?
Amazing stories to me are the people who were so horribly traumatized, and we didn't know what PTSD was, and we told anybody who said something like that, we called them a coward. And when they all came back from World War II, they were told to just get on with their lives. And I really think a whole generation of Americans suffered from various traumas going through World War II, because even when you read the history of the battle of this attack, you don't really get how gruesome and horrible it really was until you get to the people who talk about it decades later. One incredible story to me is a man is at the beach with his child, and this is almost 10 years after Pearl Harbor, and he's at the beach with his little toddler son, and a wave comes up, a rogue wave comes up and sweeps the little boy out into the water. And the man starts running towards the water to rescue him, and he freezes dead in his tracks and can't go in the ocean because he had spent, he was 18 years old, and he had spent Pearl Harbor swimming through the water, which was on fire and filled with floating dead bodies, to try and rescue injured but living people. And he was so lucky during that beach incident because he had a military dog that had become their pet, and the dog rescued the child out of the water. But that man was never able to even walk near a beach again. He had been so traumatized.
All right. Well, we do appreciate and we look forward to reading the book. Author and historian Craig Nelson. Shocking news coming out of Hollywood today with word that Angelina Jolie has filed for divorce from Brad Pitt. Joining me now to talk about it, Entertainment Tonight's senior news editor Jennifer Parros. Jen, it really seemed like these two were in it for the long haul.
Yeah, and this is so shocking because we really didn't even, hear too many specific details yet of what exactly went wrong. But this is, of course, one of the biggest couples in Hollywood announcing their divorce only after 2 years of marriage.
What have you heard about what might have happened?
So we do know that Angelina had filed for divorce in Los Angeles on Monday. We know that she filed for divorce. She cited irreconcilable differences. She actually is asking for sole physical custody, but joint legal custody. And we do know that she did mark the day of separation as this past Thursday, September 15th. Now that we're more and more that we're getting and we're hearing, it's starting to come out, and we're starting to get some clues that this was totally done last minute. Sources are telling Entertainment Tonight that Angelina had only decided that she wanted to file for divorce last week. We are hearing that Brad had just heard about this in the last couple of days. And we do know that the main reason for their split as of right now is their difference in parenting styles. We know that Brad is more of the strict parent. He wanted to keep the kids on a schedule, organized, have them like normal kids. And Angelina had more of a laid-back, free-form style of parenting. So from what we know as of right now, that's mainly what caused them to split. But again, there's definitely going to be some more details that come out in the near future of what drove them to split after six children together.
Right. I don't know. We've heard some gossip about potentially an affair. Brad Pitt, have you heard anything like that, or is that just gossip?
That's just gossip as of right now. Sources close to both Angelina and Brad say that the affair was not the cause of their split. Of course, there were a couple outlets this morning reporting that he actually had an affair with his co-star Marion Cotillard. That is not true from what we are hearing.
Sorry to hear that. Maybe, who knows?
I know. Who knows? Exactly.
Six children. They really seemed like they were, like I said, in it for the long haul.
And also, you have to look at Brad's statement, too. He actually said, I'm so saddened by this, which now is making a lot of people go, it seems like this wasn't his choice at all, and he really had no idea that this was coming. So, yeah, it's really, really sad. But yeah, it should be interesting to see what comes out in the next couple of days.
All right, Entertainment Tonight's senior news editor, Jennifer Perros, thanks so much. Let's check in now with G. Abby Lee with an update of what's trending online. Hey, G.
Hi, Lori. The Twitter world was all about two high-profile women on Tuesday. First, let's talk about Amal Clooney, a renowned human rights lawyer and wife of American actor George Clooney. She's trending at this hour because of what she said at the UN General Assembly. She accused the international body of letting ISIS get away with murder. And although many people are applauding her for speaking up, some people are arguing that she's a hypocrite because they are not in favor of her husband's open support for a Democratic presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton, and they're saying her plan to beat ISIS is not effective.
Well, she also made another remark that's trending on social media, right?
That's correct. She did say if there's a prosecution of President Assad, referring to the Syrian President Bashar Assad, I would be delighted to work on it. A lot of media outlets are tweeting about that, and it's getting a lot of attraction.
I bet it is. Mm-hmm. Who else is trending?
We don't usually talk about celebrities here, but on Tuesday was all about the Brangelina breakup. Fans of actors Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are expressing sadness over the end of one of the most high-profile celebrity marriages in America. One of the most liked tweets is by actor Keegan Allen. He tweeted, "Yo, if hashtag Brangelina can't stay together, there is no hope for anyone. SMH. That means shaking my head." More than 4,000 people liked it.
Wow. What else are people saying about the breakup?
Lori, the Twitter sphere is flooded with memes and GIFs featuring Jennifer Aniston. I don't know if you've seen any of those.
No.
It's quite funny. The actress was married to Pitt for a few years until he met Jolie on a movie set and fell in love with her. People are using pictures and videos of Aniston laughing and saying she has the last laugh because she got remarried last year. So it makes sense that another popular tweet was this. "A relationship that started from cheating should not be your definition of hashtag relationship goals. Yes, I'm talking to you, hashtag Brangelina people." But some people are also saying, although many of the Brangelina tweets are quite funny, we should also remember that there are children involved in the divorce. And as you may know, Lori, they have several beautiful children together. That's all for me today.
Thanks so much, G. We appreciate it. Follow her at G. Abby Lee. That's going to do it for us today. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For a while, it looked like the 2.5-year-old civil war in South Sudan might finally be over. In August of last year, both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar signed a peace agreement to end the conflict, the terms of which confirmed Salva Kiir as president and returned Riek Machar to government as the first vice president. But just months after Riek Machar returned to South Sudan to resume his vice presidential duties, violence resumed and Machar fled. One of the most heinous aspects of South Sudan's civil war is the forced conscription of child soldiers, children younger than 18, with far too many under the age of 15. According to UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Agency, since South Sudan's civil war began in December 2013, over 16,000 children have been recruited into armed groups on both sides. UNICEF has reported on the recruitment of child soldiers since the July 7th outbreak of violence. Both sides are using various methods, including coercion and blackmail, to force parents to surrender their children to them. The United States is profoundly alarmed by the UNICEF report. Above and beyond our calls for an end to ongoing violence in South Sudan, we insist on an immediate halt to the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers by government and opposition forces. Individuals responsible for the unlawful recruitment or use of child soldiers for armed groups or forces may be subject to sanction under U.S. law and may be targeted for U.N. sanctions, said State Department spokesman John Kirby in a written statement. The continued unlawful recruitment and use of children in armed conflict in South Sudan is unacceptable. eliminating the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers for armed groups in South Sudan is a leading priority of the United States. We remain committed to securing accountability for those who recruit and use children as soldiers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours.